very much like to impose on Saudi Arabia, because he has a very strong card to wave in front of Mohammed bin Salman, that is the assassination of Khashoggi. And this is why he's holding him by the neck,
right,
and will force the Saudi recognition of Israel before the end of his term in office in January 2021.
All right, thanks to my guest journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joining us from Caracas. Also thanks to CEO of the Ramadan Foundation, Mohammed Sheffield, joining us from the British capital, London. And also special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate. Goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be looking at a problem and a question that is very important, and that is the problem of God's being the creator of all things. This is a basic belief of the Islamic faith, of all faiths, the idea that God is the creator of all things. At the same time, we know we have been made religiously responsible to perform certain actions, and if we don't perform them, we will be punished. If we do perform them, we will be rewarded. Indirectly, this implies that we are the agents that perform these actions. Otherwise, if God was the immediate agent that performed them, and His rewarding us for our actions or punishing Him for them, would be an act of oppression, which is unbecoming of God. So we have to simultaneously affirm God's attribute of being the ultimate cause of all things, with the idea that we are the immediate agents of certain effects. A question that arises here is the following: that certain actions that we perform, or certain actions that stem from certain agents, or certain effects that stem from certain agents, are considered by us to be evil, or they're considered by us to be ugly and unbecoming, unbecoming of a being such as God. How can we ascribe these actions which are evil to God, who is a being who is purely good? And how could we ascribe these actions which are unbecoming or ugly to a being who is sheer beauty and who is wise? And these two seem to be irreconcilable with one another. In other words, there's two questions here. The first question or objection to God's being the creator of all things is this idea or the intuitive belief that we are the agents of certain actions which stem from us. This dimension of this question is not specifically related to those actions which are good or bad. It includes both of them. The answer to this question is that we are the immediate agents of these acts. However, God is the ultimate and final cause of them, and there is no contradiction between them. Another dimension to this problem is this, that specifically certain actions are evil, other actions are ugly, and therefore they cannot stem from an agent which is pure good and pure beauty and pure knowledge and wisdom. So therefore we have to make an exception to God's agency and say that there are certain things which he doesn't create. So there's two dimensions. This second dimension of this problem is specifically related to certain acts, those acts which are unbecoming and ugly and those acts which are evil. So this is something which should be independently investigated. It's a problem which is different from the first. We can talk about each one of these separately. Today we'll talk about the problem of evil very briefly. This is a problem which is historically, it's been discussed from times immemorial. One of the answers which has been given to this question is the following, that we don't actually believe that God is the creator of all things. Rather, God is the creator of the good things and the beauty in this world, and there's another creator in this world alongside God who is the creator of evil and the ugly actions that exist in this world. This is an answer which we believe is unacceptable. In essence, this is shirk and polytheism. It's dualism, of course, it's been ascribed to certain faiths, such as, apparently, it's been ascribed to Zoroastrianism. We have to address this question in some of our forthcoming, address this idea in some of our forthcoming sessions. Until then, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Round the World with Reporters.
EU leaders told Turkey in October to stop exploring in the contested Eastern Mediterranean waters or face consequences. Earlier this week, all EU states agreed that in their view, Turkey has made no positive shift away from its policy of exploring in contested waters and upped its threat of sanctions. Ankara urged the EU to act with common sense to solve the dispute, but ahead of Thursday's EU summit, Turkey's president made his stance very clear.
Any sanctions decision that can be taken against Turkey will not concern Turkey much. Since 1963, the EU is officially constantly imposing sanctions on us anyway. The EU has never acted honestly.
Germany, the current holder of the EU's six-month presidency, holds the key to whether sanctions will go ahead. However, Turkey resuming its gas exploration off Cyprus in October has angered Berlin.
Deutschland hat sich in den vergangenen Monaten
In recent months, Germany has made an extraordinary effort to find a way to intensify the dialogue between Turkey and the European Union. Regrettably, tensions between Turkey, Cyprus and Greece have not allowed direct talks to begin, and there have been far too many provocations.
Turkey's row with Greece and Cyprus over the extent of their continental shelves in the East Mediterranean flared up in August when Turkey sent a survey vessel to waters claimed by Greece. The two European nations accuse Ankara of drilling for hydrocarbons off its continental shelf. Turkey pulled the vessel out in September to allow for diplomacy with Greece, but then sent it back to the area, prompting an angry reaction from Greece, France, and Germany. However, Ankara seems unfazed.
On the Eastern Mediterranean, we will continue to protect our rights. Moreover, we will continue to protect the rights of Northern Cyprus until the end. It is never possible for us to compromise here. But if Greece really acts honestly as a neighbor, we will continue to be available at the table.
The EU created a sanctions program last year to punish what it calls unauthorized exploration in the Eastern Mediterranean Sea, freezing assets of people and companies accused of planning or participating in activities in Cyprus's exclusive economic zone or on its continental shelf. Only senior officials of Turkey's state-owned Turkish Petroleum Corporation were put on the sanctions list, but that was not enough for Greece. It is a delicate situation for Germany, having to mediate between two NATO members, Ankara and Athens, without seeming to have divided loyalties. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Government leaders meeting in Brussels have adopted proposals aimed at trying to avert chaos at EU-UK borders in the event that Britain abruptly exits the bloc's rules and regulations at the end of this month when the Brexit transition period ends on the 31st of December. This as floundering trade talks between both sides continue.
No one understates the challenges that lie ahead, but it's important for the citizens of Europe that we do everything we possibly can to get agreement here.
France has made it clear it will veto any EU-UK trade agreement that does not safeguard the livelihoods of those involved in the French fishing industry. The big sticking point for Germany is ensuring that British firms do not have unfair advantage over EU firms, for example, via state subsidies. Hardline Brexiteers do not want to see a deal, as they are worried this would align the UK too closely to the EU. Equally, there are many people in the European Union who adjudge London to be extremely arrogant. This cohort does not want to see a deal, as they'd rather look on as Britain faces the full consequences of Brexit. Those consequences might include very restricted travel to the EU from the UK from January the 1st due to the 27-nation bloc's COVID-19 rules with respect to non-members. British citizens living in the EU would likely face all sorts of bureaucracy. Then, of course, there are warnings of dire economic consequences for the UK and possibly Scottish independence. We are told the key to securing a EU-UK future relationship agreement to avoid chaos in January is fairness.
This fine balance of fairness has not been achieved so far. Our negotiators are still working, and we will take a decision on Sunday.
Even in the absence of a trade deal with the UK, EU leaders know they already face many economic challenges.
We still haven't fully resolved the problems of very high public debt, private debt still very high, banking sector problems still very present, price adjustments still ongoing.
The prospects aren't looking good. As EU leaders continued their meeting in the Belgian capital, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson stated there is a, quote, strong possibility a trade deal will not be reached. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The administration of US President Donald Trump is given the go-ahead to sell billions of dollars worth of arms to the UAE. On Wednesday, the Republican-led US Senate approved the deal proposed by the government. The contract, reportedly worth some $23 billion, includes the sales of the U.S.'s most advanced F-35 fighter jets and Reaper drones. Senators voted almost along party lines on two resolutions. All but two Democrats voted to block the deal, while one Republican broke ranks to vote against the sale. Trump had issued a formal threat to veto congressional efforts to block the weapons transfer. Those in favor of the deal described the UAE as an important U.S. partner in West Asia. Detractors, on the other hand, argued the UAE should not be armed with advanced weapons given its involvement in the war on Yemen. They also warned that such a move would ignite an arms race in the region. A couple of months ago, in a controversial move, the UAE normalized its relations with Israel. The country trampled upon years of at least verbal commitment to the Palestinian cause by recognizing Israel. It also distanced itself from the majority of the Arab countries that have no diplomatic relations with Israel over the regime's occupation of Palestinian lands. The UAE's recognition of Israel was said to be a precondition for its purchase of advanced weaponry from the United States. Therefore, F-35 jets and Reaper drones can be considered the payoff for turning their back to Palestinians. The United Arab Emirates, which is ruled by monarchs, has a bleak human rights record. The country is a staunch Saudi ally, the two of which have been leading a devastating war on Yemen since March 2015. The war has killed thousands of innocent Yemenis, including women and children, and has caused what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The UAE also openly supported anti-government militants in Syria, exacerbating the suffering of the Syrian people by fueling the bloodshed in the Arab country. It has also been actively engaged in a brutal suppression of a popular pro-democracy movement in neighboring Bahrain. Abu Dhabi is now eyeing to seize control of southern Yemen, including a strategic island there, using its proxies.
Iran and Afghanistan have launched a railway that connects the Iranian northeastern city of Khaf to Herat in the other country. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani and his Afghan counterpart Ashraf Ghani attended the inauguration ceremony through video conference due to the global corona epidemic. The two sides said the project is a pivotal one that helps boost bilateral economic ties and collaborations.
With the completion of such an important project, the commodities of your businessmen could easily be transferred to Europe. With this railway, you can have access to Iran's southern ports, including Imam Khomeini Port and Bandar Abbas, and later on to Chabahar.
For his part, the Afghan president also said that the important project will give fresh momentum to economic ties between the two countries.
We jointly put iron on earth and soil to tie the destiny of the two nations to outline our future collaborations. I offer congratulations and wish the best for the two nations and governments.
The railway is about 140 kilometers long, and after being connected to Herat, it will be about 225 kilometers. The Khaf-Herat Railway will enhance economic, cultural, and social exchanges between the two countries. It will see over 6 million tons of goods transported annually. It will also link Afghanistan through Iran to the Caspian Sea, Russia, and Europe. Humayun Abedi, Tehran.
The news that people in the United Kingdom are already getting the COVID-19 vaccine has given hope to millions of families across the globe. Families with elderly or vulnerable members are wondering when it will be their turn. According to the People's Vaccine Alliance, which includes Amnesty International and Oxfam, it might be a while. The organization says rich countries are hoarding the most promising vaccines, just as they did during the swine flu pandemic in 2009. Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech have so far sold out, despite promises of fair distribution.
We set out at the beginning to deliver this vaccine to the world, and that means fair allocations across all countries that wish to use our vaccine. So no, not all of the doses that we produce go to the UK. The UK gets, like every country, a fair proportion.
Rich countries have bought more than half the globe's supply of vaccines. That means 1 in 10 people in at least 67 poor countries will not get it unless urgent action is taken. This contradicts statements made by rich nations at the UN after General Secretary Antonio Guterres called on them to make vaccines available to all.
France proposes a donation mechanism so that a portion of the first doses of vaccines available are used to vaccinate priority groups in developing countries.
end this pandemic anywhere, we have to end it everywhere. We need a united global effort that ensures that everyone has equitable access to a potential vaccine.
Experts say this is blatantly hypocritical, though. Canada has purchased enough vaccines to immunize its entire population five times over. The same goes for the world's highest per capita buyer, the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, countries that are subject to US-led sanctions are being prevented from purchasing the vaccine. Iran is one of them. The US has imposed crippling sanctions on its banking sector and its vital oil and gas industry, and threatened punitive measures against any country or company that does business with Iran.
The pandemic has shown what humanity is capable of at its best and worst. Inspiring acts of compassion and self-sacrifice, breathtaking feats of science and innovation, and heartwarming demonstrations of solidarity. But also disturbing signs of self-interest, blame shifting, and division.
The UN is calling for a global ceasefire, debt relief for struggling nations, and a lifting of sanctions amid the COVID-19 pandemic. But it seems these calls have so far fallen on deaf ears. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan criticized U.S. administration's comments and actions against Turkish arms deal with Russia. In a presser, Erdogan, however, said he would discuss Turkish-U.S. relations with the next president once he takes office, just like it was the case before.
Aklına herhangi bir şey gelen bakıyorsunuz.
Once he assumes office, we will surely sit down and discuss certain things with Mr. Biden, just like we sat down and talked in the United States or Turkey in the past. We will discuss these again. We do not find the statements and actions they make regarding our arms procurements to be nice. We especially don't find their approach in northern Syria to be right.
Turkey and the U.S. ties have been hit by Turkey's purchase of S-400 missiles from Russia after the U.S. was unable to seal a deal on Patriot missiles. Despite the ongoing tensions and sanction threats, everyone could see the chemistry between Erdogan and Trump. The chemistry that Erdogan-Biden relation is definitely not going to have. Analysts worry about the future of relations between Ankara and Washington.
Turkish President's statement on Turkish-U.S. relations is aimed to build a good relation with Washington, especially now that Joe Biden will take office. However, it is not guaranteed that things will go well due to differences between the two allies. The U.S. still insists on its support to Kurdish militants and tries to impose its strategies on Turkey, which is not acceptable for the government here. Therefore, I think tensions will continue to escalate between the two states.
The tension between the two NATO allies goes back to 2003, when Ankara refused to permit U.S. troops to cross its borders to Iraq. The tensions escalated due to different views on the Syrian crisis and Turkey's purchase of S-400 from Russia. Despite the ongoing tensions, many believe that both Ankara and Washington need each other's support in different arenas. This will force Erdogan and Biden to talk things out. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
A number of ambassadors and military attachés of different countries in Taiwan have signed a memorial book to commemorate the high status of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the top Iranian scientist who was assassinated on November 27th. The diplomats have voiced their hatred and condemnation against this act of terror.
Right after the assassination, Russia has strongly condemned the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh and believes that the main goal of such assassinations to destabilize the region and those who were behind his assassination should be severely punished.
As the ambassador of Iraq, we extend our condolences to the Iranian nation. Iraq has repeatedly seen many of such assassinations carried out by its enemies. Therefore, we fully understand the depth of the tragedy. We condemn Mohsen Fakhrizadeh's assassination and call on the international community to get united against all forms of terrorism.
Fakhrizadeh, who headed the Defense Ministry's Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, was assassinated after his car was ambushed in the town of Absert, east of the capital Tehran. He was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but succumbed to his wounds. The scientist had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote a once peaceful nuclear energy program.
We believe that if countries remain silent towards such acts of terror and assassination, terrorists will become emboldened to continue their acts of terrorism. Therefore, ambassador and military attaché of different countries have signed a memorial book both to pay tribute to Mohsen Fakhrizadeh and condemn his assassination.
Experts believe the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt a once peaceful nuclear program.
The ambassadors and military attachés of different countries who commemorated Mohsen Fakhrizadeh strongly condemned his assassination, saying the main perpetrators should be brought to justice anytime soon. Salman Kujiri, Tehran.
Syria's new foreign minister, Faisal al-Miqdad, is in Iran on his first foreign trip since he was appointed. On Monday, he met his Iranian counterpart, Mohammad Javad Zarif. Miqdad later met Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani, and head of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, where the two sides talked about regional issues, such as the fight against terrorism and U.S.'s destabilizing role in the Middle East.
Iran's measures to fight the terrorists in Syria have always been welcomed by the Syrian government and people. The Iran-Russia-Syria coalition to fight Daesh terrorists in Syria is a case in point, which effectively dismantled Daesh from the Arab country. Iran's time and again emphasized on a political solution to Syria's crisis, while the U.S. continues to fund and arm terrorists in Syria with the aim of toppling the government.
Syria is one of Iran's strategic regional allies. However, despite their high level of political ties, both sides agree that the level of bilateral trade between the two countries is still low. Last year, the trade volume between Iran and Syria was around $80 million. Before the Syrian conflict began in 2011, the figure stood at over $1.5 billion. This means that the conflict has been a hurdle in the way of their bilateral trade. But it's not the only problem. The existing U.S. sanctions on both countries plays a significant role.
The U.S. resorted to many ways to disrupt Iran's fight against terrorism in Syria, including the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. Washington's sanctions on Syria follow the same goal of restricting and help from Iran and Russia to the Arab country. The White House isn't willing to see that its terrorist mercenaries are defeated there.
Reconstruction of Syria has been a hot topic since the expulsion of Daesh terrorists from the Arab country. The United Nations estimates the cost of rebuilding Syria at $250 billion. Currently, Iran is active in a range of economic sectors in Syria, from transport to energy and engineering. Faisal al-Miqdad was named Syria's new foreign minister following the recent death of his predecessor, Walid al-Muallim. The top Syrian diplomat says he will keep up his country's strategic cooperation with Tehran, especially in the fight against foreign-backed terrorists in the region. He says this is a fundamental step toward restoring peace and security in Syria and the Middle East. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
During Donald Trump's 4 years in office, relations between the European Union and the United States deteriorated so badly that the sides almost became bitter adversaries. Washington's illegal economic sanctions against Iran have prevented EU firms from doing business with the Islamic Republic. Apparently, it is an example of why the bloc needs to become more autonomous.
We don't accept this kind of extraterritoriality, but in practical terms, it has effects. Well, if we don't accept, we should be able to resist it.
Aside from the Iran nuclear deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, Trump has pushed back against the EU on trade, climate change, and how to handle COVID-19. Those are only a few examples. EU foreign affairs ministers have just adopted a policy document designed to repair the damage when Joe Biden enters the White House next month. The document states we need to work together to preserve the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action as endorsed by United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231-2015. But despite the EU's seemingly positive ambitions, there are many analysts who agree the nuclear deal will not be saved because ultimately the Biden administration will bow to Israeli regime pressure. Trump's hate speech towards Iran, fueled by the powerful Israel lobby, has been relentless during the past 4 years.
We're going to hit you with a force 1,000 times bigger than you've ever been hit before.
Despite Trump and Israel's best efforts, some expert analysts believe Iran's political leaders can still save the nuclear deal.
It is a sensitive issue. And like in the U.S. Congress, also in the Iranian parliament, there are people who are, if not opposed, at least critical. But the foreign ministry and the government, I think, are very, very determined to carry out this deal.
Biden has said he wants to re-engage with Iran. Tehran has made it clear matters will not be progressed at any price. Jerome Hughes, Brussels. Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah al-Aliyy al-Azim. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد. وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في العربين أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوانه وأنصاره. Last night we spoke about the way that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has provided humanity with guidance for their personal progress and also for establishing a community, a universal community based on justice as a major value and other values that inshallah we will talk about it. When it comes to personal progress, all the prophets helped humanity in order to combat their ego, in order to combat temptations coming from their nafs ammara, their commanding soul, from Satan. They try to take them from darkness to light. But when it comes to establishing a just society, it was the job of the messengers, of the Rusul, who were given the book and mizan, the scale or the balance, so that they would lead and guide humanity towards establishment of this social justice. لَقَدْ أَرْسَلْنَا رُسُلَنَا بِالْبَيِّنَاتِ وَأَنزَلْنَا مَعَهُمُ الْكِتَابَ وَالْمِيزَانَ لِيَقُومَ النَّاسُ بِالْقِسْطِ.
One of the beautiful verses of the Quran about this ummah which is going to be established, this community which is going to be established, is this ayah, Surah Baqarah, verse 143. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وكذلك جعلناكم أمة وسطا لتكونوا شهداء على الناس. We have designed Islam in the way that you can be a balanced nation so that you would be witnesses for other nations. If Prophet is your leader, he is a witness for you, you are also to be leader and witness for other people. لتكونوا شهداء على الناس ويكون الرسول عليكم شهيدا. Rasulullah is your leader, and you have to follow him and become leader for other nations. Not by force, not by sword. There is no matter of sword. And was Rasulullah leader of Muslims by sword? No, they loved him. They followed him because they loved him. If you are balanced, people follow you because they love you. If people see that our community, and we don't need to wait, you know, for the whole Ummah to wake up. We can start from our own local community. We can start from London. We can start from even Northwest London or any part of, you know, any town. This can start with few people. Most of the prophets started with few people. Yes, some of the prophets inherited already an Ummah, a community. But many people started with just few people. We can start it from here. If we achieve this balance, and this has many, many dimensions, balance between secular education and religious education. This needs by itself, you know, one Muharram to talk. How we sometimes lose this balance. Everything goes for secular education. Or in rare cases, everything goes for religious education. Both are wrong. Of course, the first is more common, but maybe the second is also happening. We need both. We don't need to sacrifice one for the sake of other. Why we cannot be very advanced in secular education, but at the same time be very advanced in religious education? Why we cannot spend money, energy, attention to the religious education of our children as we do for our secular education?
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here, who created us, who we must fear.
So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
I know that there are people who even have financial problems, but still they are ready, and I don't, you know, have any problem, I appreciate, to borrow money to send their children to private schools or government schools. They have really shortage of money, but still they're happy to do this. This is good. I'm not saying they should stop or they should do. I'm saying I don't have any problem. But how many people are ready to borrow money to provide their children with religious education? When it comes to religious education, we do tawakkul. Inshallah, it will be all right. When it comes to secular education, there is no tawakkul. Even when sometimes, you know, we say, people, you know, please let us have our own Islamic schools. And if we work as a community, for sure, even in secular, you know, records, we can be very successful. But they say, no, we cannot take risk. We can send our children, you know, to schools which are already established. They don't do any tawakkul. They don't do any sacrifice. They are not ready to take any risk. Although this is not a risk which is not realistic. If we really work together as a community, we can have best secular education in our Islamic schools. But there is no sign of tawakkul here. But when it comes to religious education, just attending mosque, we think it's enough, if we attend. Just sending to madrasa for a few hours, we think it's enough. So this is not going to work. We need to have balance.
I'm looking back throughout the years. To breathe is hard, and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
O Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. O Allah, please forgive us. Please forgive all our sins and mistakes and shortcomings. Please enable us to serve you with full honesty and truthfulness and sincerity. Please include us among the best followers of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. Please protect and safeguard our community and our families and our youths from everything that you don't like. O Allah, please hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Please make our Imam Zaman happy with what we do and what we say. Please answer his du'as for his faraj. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. O Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraji, those who have passed away. Please let them be with Muhammad and Ali Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraji who are alive. O Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. Wa akhiru da'wana and alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
My ummah, he will say. Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of his way. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the rise again, let us see daylight again, once again.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. With the coronavirus pandemic surging and initial vaccine supplies limited, the United States faces a hard choice. Should the country's immunization program focus in the early months on the elderly and people with serious medical conditions who are dying of the coronavirus at the highest rates, or on essential workers, an expansive category encompassing Americans who have borne the greatest risk of coronavirus infection? The article you're about to hear has been written by journalists Abby Goodenough and Jan Hoffman, writing for the New York Times. The piece is titled The Elderly versus Essential Workers, Who Should Get the Coronavirus Vaccine First? Stay with us for more of Abby Goodenough and Jan Hoffman's article. Coronavirus pandemic surging and initial vaccine supplies limited, the United States faces a hard choice. Should the country's immunization program focus in the early months on the elderly and people with serious medical conditions who are dying of the virus at the highest rates, or on essential workers, an expansive category encompassing Americans who have borne the greatest risk of coronavirus infection? Healthcare workers and the frailest of the elderly, residents of long-term care facilities, will almost certainly get the first shots of the vaccine under guidelines from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. The guidelines issued on Thursday. But with vaccination expected to start this month, the debate among federal and state health officials about who goes next and lobbying from outside groups to be included is growing more urgent. It's a question increasingly guided by concerns over the inequities laid bare by the pandemic, from disproportionately high rates of infection and death among poor people and people of color, to disparate access to testing, childcare, and technology for online schooling. It's a damnable that we are even being placed in this position, that we have to make these choices, said Reverend William J. Barber II, a co-chairman of the Poor People's Campaign, a national coalition that calls attention to the challenges of the working poor. But if we have to make the choice, we cannot once again leave poor people and low-wealth essential workers to be last. Ultimately, the choice comes down to whether preventing death or curbing the spread of the coronavirus and returning to some semblance of normalcy is the highest priority. If your goal is to maximize the preservation of human life, then you would bias the vaccine towards older Americans, Dr. Scott Gottlieb, the former Food and Drug Administration FDA commissioner, said recently. Dr. Scott Gottlieb added, if your goal is to reduce the rate of coronavirus infection, then you would prioritize essential workers. So it depends what impact you're trying to achieve. The trade-off between the two is muddied by the fact that the definition of essential workers used by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, comprises nearly 70% of the American workforce, sweeping in not just grocery store clerks and emergency responders, but also tugboat operators and nuclear energy workers. Some labor economists and public health officials consider the category overboard and say it should be narrowed to only those who interact in person with the public. About 70% of workers in the U.S. have jobs that are considered essential. A subset are considered frontline workers, meaning their jobs cannot be performed from home. An independent committee of medical experts that advises the CDC on immunization practices will soon vote on whom to recommend for the second phase of vaccination, Phase 1B. Meeting last month, all voting members of the committee indicated support for putting essential workers ahead of people over the age of 65 and older, and those with higher risk health conditions. An independent committee of medical experts that advises the Center for Disease Control and Prevention on immunization practices will soon vote on whom to recommend for the second phase of vaccination. Historically, the committee relied on scientific evidence to inform its decisions, but now the members are weighing social justice concerns as well. According to Lisa Posser, a professor of health policy and decision sciences at the University of Michigan, Dr. Liesel, Prosser says, to me the issue of ethics is very significant, very important for this country. Dr. Peter Zilagli, a committee member and a pediatrics professor at the University of California in Los Angeles, says at the time, clearly this favors the essential workers group because of the high proportion of minority, low-income and low-education workers among essential workers. That position runs counter to the framework proposed by the World Health Organization, WHO, the National Academies of Science, Engineering and Medicine, and many countries which say that reducing deaths should be the unequivocal priority, and that older and sicker people should thus go before the workers, a view shared by many in the public health and medicine industry. Dr. Robert Redfield, the director of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, and the nation's top public health official, reminded the advisory committee of the importance of older people, saying in a statement on Thursday that he looked forward to future recommendations that, based on vaccine availability, demonstrate that we as a nation also prioritize the elderly. Once the committee votes, Dr. Robert Redfield will decide whether to accept its recommendations as the official guidance of the agency. Only rarely does the CDC director reject a recommendation from the committee, whose 14 members are selected by the Health and Human Services Secretary, serve 4.5-year terms, and have never confronted a task as high in profile as this one. But ultimately, the decision will be up to governors and state and local officials, health officials. They are not required to follow the CDC guidelines, though historically they have done so in the past.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, how to utilize your life effectively. Brothers and sisters, we said that life is precious and time management is very precious as well. How can you best utilize your time? Number one, connecting with Allah. Number two, ignoring time wasters. Number three, planning appropriately. Number four, subscribing to a not-to-do list. Next one, avoiding procrastination. Next one, remembering your time is limited. Last but not the least, sticking to a schedule. Well, today we're going to discuss the third one, which is planning appropriately. We need to organize our lives as Muslims. Our life is a trust from Allah and it has a timeline. Hence, the need for daily, weekly, monthly, and yearly plans is inevitable. We plan in awe of a bright future, hoping Allah spares our lives for good. So set high standards for yourself. Keep your eyes focused on your goals and see the big picture. trust Allah's decision, but put in time and effort to achieve what you plan. Sometimes we trust Allah, or we think or we feel that we trust Allah, we rely on Allah, and we are dependent on Allah, but the necessary and essential effort and scheduling and planning is absent in our calculations. So what ends up happening? We don't get the desired result, and then we, in our hearts sometimes and sometimes openly, start blaming Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Well, guess what? The shortcoming was not from Allah's side. You were missing out on planning appropriately. You did not manage time. You did not put in the required effort. It is not Allah, but you who are to be blamed. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing how to utilize your life effectively. And we said time management is a crucial and essential piece of it. Now, we discussed three of the tips that we've been trying to give you to be able to manage your life better. And today we are going to talk about another one of them, and that is subscribing to a not-to-do list. You know how a to-do list is a very useful tool for highly productive people, right? In the times we live now, a not-to-do list is more important in order to avert distractions. It is as simple as spelling out the things that are not productive and finding a means to do away with them. On the other hand, prioritizing is necessary in order to get things done and produce meaningful results. So make sure that you have a to-do list in your life that is going to allow you to manage your affairs, day-to-day affairs, effectively and productively. And, you know, you're not going to forget things easily because now you have written them down. Now, not to-do list is more important, brothers and sisters, right? Because these not to-do lists, what they do is they would keep you from falling to those items which are going to be a hindrance in you getting to your to-do list. So if you want to go to and perform your to-do list, this not-to-do list is actually a complementary and supplementary and supportive list. Sometimes, you know, we have seen, just to give you an example, we're playing video game and then it's namaz time. We know that namaz is on our to-do list, right? But because of this video game, we are so absorbed into it that the namaz time comes and namaz time passes by, and we're still engaged with this video game. Now imagine if you had it on your not-to-do list. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.